two different states, and then I do some cut, means a bipartition like this, then the phenomenon entropy is just the sum of the two. So the third property that yesterday I didn't mention is that the phenomenon entropy is invariant under local transformations. So this is important because, so by a local transformation, I mean this. Imagine this is our system, and this is our subregion A. And imagine that I make some unitary transformation with support on this region or with support on this region. So these transformations cannot, imagine that we start from a separable state, they cannot make our state entangled because this will be just some basis transformation, some subset here. But in order to entangle with respect to the bipartition AB, you must act on both A and B at the same time. So in particular, the phenomenon entropy has this property. So it's invariant under local operations. OK. So we would like to understand what happens when our system is not just a system with a few particles, but it's a quantum many-body system. So when our H is equal to the tensor product of many degrees of freedom. And then, so I here belongs to some lattice lambda. Then if I do a bipartition on my lattice lambda in A union B that are not intersecating, then I can write this like the tensor product of my degrees of freedom in A times the tensor product of my degrees of freedom in B, which gives me this bipartition here. OK. So what happens to entanglement in this case? So imagine that I just pick one state in this Hilbert space randomly. So it is a very notable result that most states in the Hilbert space are extremely entangled. So this means that if I from psi compute the rho A, and then I compute my phenomenon entropy of rho A, I will obtain something that goes like some constants times L to the D, where, so let me redraw this drawing bigger. So this is A, and L is the diameter of my region A. So this is the volume of A. So another property, so this is a simple exercise to do, is to prove that the maximum entanglement for some state psi. So imagine that psi is my state, it is maximally entangled. Its entropy would be like the logarithm over the dimension of the Hilbert space. actually of the Hilbert space in A. So here I'm assuming that A has a smaller dimension than B. So here is whichever is the smallest. So this is the maximum possible entanglement. But so we know that this dimension, for instance, in a spin system, grows like 2 to the number of spins that we have in A, which is 2 to the L to the D, because it's the volume of the region A. So, and then you take the log, so you see that you get something that is a constant times L to the D. So if I take a psi, a random state in the Hilbert space, we almost always see this. Of course, because it's random, we might happen to pick some state that is a factorizable state, its entanglement is zero, or it has a much weaker entanglement than this. But if you do the statistics of this, you can prove that the probability of picking a state that is not maximally entangled goes to zero exponentially fast in L. So we are almost assured that if we take a state in the Hilbert space, this is maximally entangled. So almost always. But we are interested not in random states in the Hilbert space, but in some specific class of states that are important in condensed matter theory. So we are concerned with psi zero states that are ground states of local Hamiltonians. So only recently, people have tried to count how many states have these properties in the total Hilbert space. And it has been proven that the number of these states, so the number of such psi zero, is actually a double exponential. So this is small l and this is exp. In the system sites with respect to the number of total states in the Hilbert space. So the interesting states that for us in quantum unibody theory are, first of all, ground states, and ground states of a local Hamiltonian are actually very rare in the Hilbert space. Yeah. This is actually L to the L. So the interesting states are rare. So other interesting states are, so this is insofar we're interested to static properties of our system. The other thing that we might be interested in is to prepare some state that is the ground state of some local Hamiltonian. Then we kick the Hamiltonian in some way. So psi zero is the ground state of certain H zero. Then at T equals zero, we add a perturbation V to the Hamiltonian so that my actual Hamiltonian is H zero plus V. So this state is not the eigenstate of this Hamiltonian. It was just prepared as the eigenstate of this one, but the evolving Hamiltonian is this one. So psi of t will evolve in time, of course, in this way. So this scenario is called quantum quench, and it's actually the typical thing that you can do in the lab, and there are actual experiments in ultra cold atom gases where you can actually realize this scenario and have an actual unitary evolution for very long time scales. So if I'm not mistaken, to the order of seconds, which is a lot. Even more than that, even tens of seconds. Okay, so this also may be interesting states, right? Because it's something that we can do in the lab. And we can imagine that we have some time-dependent perturbations in our system, so that we also want to understand how our systems behave away from equilibrium. Because psi zero is a ground state, so it's an equilibrium state, but we might be interested in away from equilibrium. So also these states are rare. So if you do the count, this counting is similar. So now we ask ourselves, how entangled are these states? So, and today we will talk about the equilibrium case. So we will forget, we will not answer this question, how entangled they are away from equilibrium, but just the ground states. How entangled are they? Okay, so now the picture is this. So now I'll produce a hand-waving argument. So you know that entanglement is some form of correlations. Actually, there are correlations that can be stronger than classical. But you may think of entanglement as some form of correlation. And so imagine now that we are in some gapped state. So our psi zero is the ground state of a non-critical Hamiltonian. So this means that we have a gap, which means that we have a finite correlation length, which means all correlation functions decay exponentially, as we proved. So now, if this is true, also for entanglement, then we might make the ansatz that only the degrees of freedom that are nearby are actually entangled. So we are interested in the entanglement between the degrees of freedom in A and the degrees of freedom in B. But some degree of freedom in the bulk of B should not be strongly entangled with these degrees of freedom in the bulk of A, because this should decay exponentially. So if all the degrees of freedom were entangled with each other, we would expect that the entanglement scales like the number of degrees of freedom in A. And then we would get the volume law, right? Because this is the number of degrees of freedom in A. But if this picture is correct, then this cannot happen. So this number must be only those that are near the boundary. So there will be some typical thickness that we would like to think that it's some entanglement correlation length, xi prime. And then there is the boundary. So if this is true, we would expect that our entropy scales like some constant to L to the minus 1 plus beta. And this is called area law. Of course, here, because I drew a two-dimensional system, I mean, I should say boundary law, but people always refer to it as an area law because they have always in mind the 3D. So this is an abuse of language. This is what people say. So this is the scaling, L to D minus 1. Well, instead, if psi 0 is critical, so if psi 0 is the ground state of a critical Hamiltonian, well, still our correlation functions decay, but they decay with a power law. So these are our correlation functions decay like L to some power. Well, so what happens to entanglement? So this is, even with the end waving argument, this is difficult to guess. Okay, so let's see some results. So these results are non-trivial. Actually, they're extremely difficult to obtain, so I will just list you what is the state of the results that we know. So for the 1D system, first of all, so D is equal 1. Well, so we have two cases, the gap case and the gapless case, meaning the non-critical, sorry, equals 0, and the critical case. Well, so if D is equal 1, then the boundary of our system, so in this case, we have a spin chain, and we take a block of spins of length L, and this is what we call A, and the rest of the spins in the chain are B. Well, but the boundary here is some constant. So there is a complicated expression, but this complicated expression for L large saturates to some constant alpha. Let me call it alpha tilde. So this is what would happen for D equal 1, right? So this is the area law in 1D. This becomes a constant times a constant plus a constant, which is a constant. Let me comment that this alpha tilde is not universal. So by not universal, this means that if I perturb, so that is not robust under perturbations of H. So if I put a small perturbation in my Hamiltonian, then if I started in the system where there was a gap, so I'm away from criticality, so I am deep in the phase, as we say, then a perturbation would not produce a phase transition, so I will still be in the same phase. Nevertheless, this alpha tilde, the exact value of this constant changes, so it's not a universal property of the phase. But the scaling is, so you have the area law. Instead, for the gapless system, you have C over 3 log L plus a constant beta. So this is also non-universal. And now you see that we have a logarithmic violation to the area law. So that in fact, in the if this region for very large L, the entanglement is diverging, but it's diverging very quickly, very weakly. And this is because our correlations decay much slower. So there can be a contribution of the entanglement that comes from the bulk, but it's very weak. So this is bulk entanglement. And this C is instead universal. And what it is? So the critical system, for instance, the critical 1D system. So we didn't do the continuum theory. So maybe I will show you this if I have time at the end of the course. But in the continuum limit, this becomes a conformal field theory, CFT, that is characterized by a central charge C, and C is exactly this object here. Okay, so this is the situation in 1D. Then we have 2D systems. 2D systems have following behavior. So for instance, it changes a lot if we have spin systems or fermionic system. So for spin systems, so this is not a theorem, but in all the known examples, we have the area law. Yeah. Whereas in the fermionic system, we have this plus so typically for fermionic systems, we do have this logarithmic divergent correction to the area law. And in 3D, so also in the known examples for spin systems, we have the area law. And this type of behavior for fermionic systems, but we know not as many examples. And we do not have, so the complete zoology of these behaviors is not known, and we do not have rigorous theorems that exhaust all the possibilities. Yeah. So for instance, a free fermion system, for instance. Just like what you obtain when you diagonal. So this is, no, you can have a fermionic system also in a lattice system, but these results are true both in the lattice systems than in the continuum theory.
For the fermionic systems, is there no difference if you are in the critical point or?
Oh, no, no, no. So there is, yes. So the logarithmic divergent. So this makes a difference between the continuum theory. If you have a gap, then you don't have this thing. So if you do not have a gap because either you are in the continuum theory or because even if you are on the lattice theory but you are at a critical point, then you have this logarithmic divergence. OK. So this is, and in all the known examples, so this constants are typically non-universal with some exceptions that are very notable. It will be something important that we'll discuss later. But in all the known examples with symmetry breaking, they are not universal. OK, so this is what I wanted to say about entanglement for now. And now we move on to a new topic, that is, we try to go beyond the symmetry breaking. Paradigm. So the symmetry breaking paradigm, as we saw many times, is based on the fact that there can be some observable, some local order parameter that spontaneously, so spontaneously means what happens in the thermodynamic limit, if you first take the thermodynamic limit and then you send to zero some symmetry breaking external condition. There is some observable, I was saying, that would acquire spontaneously a non-vanishing value. So let me use this jargon and say that the symmetry breaking paradigm is that we have some spontaneous magnetization. Well, because in spin systems, this is what the local order parameter says. So the magnetization is just a jargon to say local order parameter. So it would be interesting to see if this is the only possibility. So can we have different phases without magnetization? So in our treatment of the Ising model, we saw that we have two different phases, because we have a phase in which there is no magnetization, another phase where there is magnetization. But if there is never magnetization, okay, we have two different phases. Okay, so motivated by this question, Wagner in the 71 invented the lattice gauge theory. And the logic that he followed was the following. So a lattice gauge theory is obtained by promoting my, so it's like having an Ising model. And you remember that the Ising model has a global Z2 symmetry. And he wanted to promote this global Z2 symmetry to a local one. Local Z2 symmetry. So I was imagining, let's try to see if I can invent an Ising model where the Z2 symmetry is local. Then because when the symmetry is local, there is a theorem that I will show you due to Elitsur that says, oh, there can be no magnetization. Or in other words, no spontaneous symmetry breaking. So this is a way to build models that do not have magnetization. And then we have the question, can a model like this have different phases? So if not, we are back to square one. Means that, yeah, all we know is that you can have different phases because you have symmetry breaking. So symmetry is the only notion that is important. But if you find different phases, then there must be something else. OK, so let's describe this theory. So lattice gauge theory, and let me put in parentheses Z2. OK, so we start with a d-dimensional hypercubic lattice. And I will use the following notation. So imagine that, okay, so this is some plane in my hypercubic lattice, and this is a site on my lattice. These are links on my lattice. So I will label the sites by n, and I will label the links with a pair that is a site, comma, a vector. So for instance, the vector mu, in this case, mu is just what I would call hat x. Okay? So I will label the links on my lattice by saying where the link starts from and in what direction it points. Then if this site is n, I can label this site like n plus mu. And then I could label this link here like n plus mu, comma, another vector nu, that in this case nu would be hat y, and so on and so forth. So this is the labeling that I will be using. And on every link, we place Ising variables that I will call sigma 3 as a reminiscence of sigma z. But these are just variables that can have two possible values, plus 1 and minus 1, like just like s when we started doing the Ising mode. And then I will define my local gauge symmetry. So my local gauge symmetry is some transformation on the spin configurations that is local, so it's based on some site n. So gn. And what gn does is to change, so invert all the spins that come out of the site n. So if this is up, up, down, down, this will become down, down, up, up. Okay, so this is my local gauge transformation. Okay, so now we must write some energy that is made of gauge invariant quantities, right? Just like the global Z2 symmetry was a symmetry of our energy, so our energy wouldn't change for a global Z2 symmetry. Now it must not change for this local Z2. So why I call it Z2 is because the transformations, the local group of transformations that I can have contains only two elements. One is the identity that must always be there, means I do nothing. And the other one is this one. So that's why it's called local Z2. Okay, so we need to find some function of my sigma 3 variables that is invariant under this transformation, no matter where I place them. So if you think about it, you will see that if I draw a loop on my lattice, so this loop contains sigma 3 variables all around, and to this loop I associate this quantity that is the product of sigma 3 on all the links that belong to this loop C. So this loop, let me call it C. So you can see that this quantity is gauge invariant. And the reason is that at every site, I would change my sigma 3 variables an even number of times. And when I multiply them all together, I would always get the same number. So if this quantity, so this is a product of variables that are plus 1 or minus 1. So also this object has values plus 1 or minus 1. So if in one configuration is plus 1, doing a transformation here would just change this configuration. Imagine that this was plus plus to minus minus, but the product wouldn't feel that. And the same if whatever is the value of this product, it will not change if I do a local gauge transformation. So this is gauge invariant. So these are good functions that I can put in my Hamiltonian. And we typically want our energy to be made of terms that are as local as possible, because this is more physical than something that extends on arbitrarily far apart degrees of freedom. So a good Hamiltonian would be the sum of terms of this type. So I would have sigma 3 at n mu, sigma 3 at n plus mu nu, sigma 3 at n plus mu plus nu minus mu, and then sigma 3 at n nu. So namely, I have just labeled. So if I take a plaquette in my lattice and I start from the lower left angle that I call it n, I have just labeled these four spins and I've taken the product of sigma 3 around this plaquette. So for this reason, I will also use the notation sigma 3, or even more compact, I'm summing over all the plaquettes. Okay, so this is our theory. And now we would like to see what are the properties of this theory. So first of all, let me show you. This is gauge invariant. Okay, so what I have to show you now is that because there is a local gauge symmetry, there is no possible magnetization. Okay, because if there is a magnetization, this is just another model, right? It has nothing interesting. So we must be sure that it goes beyond the symmetry breaking paradigm. And then we must show that it has different phases. Okay. So to show that there is no magnetization, so this is called Elitzur theorem. It can be proven in general. And I will prove it for this model. And the proof, it's not really more instructive in the more general cases. It's basically the same proof with a lot of messy details that do not contain. Is there any more chalk? All right, I have to do with this. Yeah, no, there is a purple chalk. Oh, good, thanks. Very good. Okay, so let's see if I manage to prove the Elitzur theorem in this time. Okay, so we want to, so how do we prove that there is a spontaneous magnetization? We use the method of sources. Which, if you remember, means that we add to our Hamiltonian a term that is breaking our symmetries, in this case, our local symmetries. So I will add a term minus H sigma 3 on every edge, on every link. Then I will compute my expectation value for sigma 3 at some site. So let me do this here. L in the presence of this. Then we take the thermodynamic limit. Thermodynamic limit. And then we take H going to zero. And if it, there is a residual value different from zero, we call it spontaneous magnetization. So again, the spontaneous magnetization is the extreme sensitivity to the, our initial conditions, such that even when we send them to zero, depending if they come from zero plus or zero minus, we are left with a spontaneous. We have already ordered the system. The system doesn't want to disorder again. Okay, so this is what we usually do. And we will do it now, and we'll see that it fails. Because I want to show that this object is zero always. For every finite temperature. Okay, so let's do that. So what is our sigma 3 at some site L? Or at some, so let me use the N, and then I have mu. So for instance, I'm computing the magnetic, the expectation value of sigma 3 on this link. Well, this is 1 over z, the partition function. Then we have the sum over all the spin configurations. And then we have our sigma 3. Then we have e to the minus beta, our Hamiltonian. And what is this? 1 over z, the sum over all the spin configurations. And then we have e to the plus, then we have beta, then we have j sum over my plaquettes plus h sum on my sigma 3. So this is on all the links, and this is on all the plaquettes. And this sum is over all the spin configurations. OK, so now we want to see what happens if we do a gauge transformation. So if we do a gauge transformation, and we want to express this quantity in the new variables, it will not be exactly the same quantity, because this term breaks our local gauge invariants. So we want to see how it transforms under a gauge transformation. So my gauge, so imagine that I apply G at the site N, and we want to see how things change. Well, this term is gauge invariant. So when I go from sigma 3 to sigma prime 3, just delta, our plaquette terms are equal to the primed ones, because this is gauge invariant. However, this is not gauge invariant. We must see how it transforms. So we have two possibilities. So either, so let me call, so this is the sum over all the possible edges, links, but I've made a local transformation the site n. So let me call ln the set of links So links that come out of the site N. So if L does not belong to this, then this quantity is completely untouched by my gauge transformation. And so my H sigma L sigma 3 goes into itself in the prime, in the prime variables. And they're the same. So the, we only have to take into account the situations in which L belongs to Ln. This is how much. So all the change will come from this term restricted to the spins here. So we will then say that H SL S3 sigma 3 L becomes H SL sigma prime 3 L minus H sum over the L that belong to LN, some correction delta L. What is this delta L? So delta L is so delta sigma L. So delta sigma L is S prime at L minus S. No, let me just go like this. Well, and what is this? This is minus sigma 3. So this is just equal to minus 2 sigma 3. Okay, so our expectation value becomes, in the new variables, becomes 1 over zeta, sum over all the configurations. So sigma 3 has become minus sigma prime 3, right? Because I have made the gauge transformation quite at n, so all the variables that come out from there are flipped to the sign. So in terms of the primed variable, I have to put the minus. And then I have this term, exp of minus h delta sigma 3. This is for the L that belong to Ln. And then I have another exponential that is the exponential. Okay, there is a beta always. So I have the exponential of beta j in the prime variable plus beta h in the prime variable. So now I'm summing over all the possible configurations. So this means that sigma, so that prime is a dummy variable because I'm summing on all the possible configurations anyway. So I can just remove the primes. So this, but now you see that I have this quantity that is summed over all the spin configurations. This is just my Hamiltonian. This is a partition function. So this is, by definition, the expectation value of minus sigma 3 and mu exp this object, minus beta h sum of delta sigma. So now you see that even now, if I want to take the thermodynamic limit, nothing really changes. Because this term, so this sum is over a finite set that are the L belonging to Ln. In the Ising model in 2D, when I do my global transformation, the energy changes for an amount that goes like the perimeter, so that when I take the thermodynamic limit, these perimeters, so this term would diverge, but here it remains constant. So a local gauge transformation only gives me a finite correction, so that cannot produce a extensive energy barrier between two different configurations. So I can also imagine that here I take the thermodynamic limit because this is just insensitive to the thermodynamic limit. And now I want to see if there is any difference between the expectation value of this quantity and of its opposite. So I want to see if there is some residual magnetization. And let me put H here because this is the expectation value in the presence of this field. That's why we have this term here. And only in the end, we send H to 0. Yeah.
Can you put H to 0 directly there?
Yeah, but then you don't prove what I want to prove.
So, but yeah, you look at the magnetization is 0.
You just see that it's equal to its opposite.
Yeah.
You have minus sign.
Yeah, I know, but.
Oh, so you get two times the correlation function, see.
Well, it. So let me think for a second whether what I'm gonna do is more rigorous than just doing this. So you're saying that if I put H to 0 right now, this would just be 1. Yeah, okay. So what I would prove is that it's something true but useless. I would prove that the expectation value of sigma 3 is equal to the expectation value of minus sigma 3.
And minus could be taken out. Value.
Yeah, but then this wouldn't automatically prove that this is zero. Okay, I see. So the point is whether we can take this out or not. Okay. Well, anyway, I was going to do something that is only slightly different from this. I just wanted to say that, yeah, pretty much it's the same thing. I just wanted to say that I can bound this term by choosing, so the maximum value of this object here is minus. So for every edge, I get a minus 2, right? So this is the maximum possible value of this exponential. And how many edges I have is 2 times the dimension. So I just wanted to bound this object like e to the 4 beta dh. And now I want to. So I know that this quantity is smaller than this quantity times this. And then I can send, because you know, this thing means that we are summing over all the possible configurations. And then you, in principle, should evaluate this object for all the possible configurations. So in order to be sure that, oh yeah, but it's fine, it will go to 1 when h is 0, well, the rigorous way to do it is say, OK, this is at most this expectation value times this, and then this when h is 0 goes to 1, and then we have the result. Well, so this concludes the proof. Okay, so sigma 3 is 0 when h goes to 0, even in the thermodynamic limit. Okay, so this is a big thing. So a local gauge symmetry cannot be spontaneously broken. which should leave you with a scary question, because you all know the Higgs mechanism, right? So the Higgs mechanism, you have some local symmetry. You say, are we, it's spontaneously broken, and then this gives mass to the photon or to the particles. So how is it possible if this proof is true in general? Okay, so it turns out that what people call spontaneous symmetry breaking in high energy theory and statistical mechanics is not exactly the same thing. So we call a residual value. So we mean that when we average over all the possible configurations, we get some value that is different from zero. The mechanism that you use in the Higgs mechanism is that you just know that there are many minima, and this is what you call spontaneous symmetry breaking. But if you did the average, it would still be zero. So it wouldn't be a spontaneous symmetry breaking in our sense. Then typically what you do is that you choose one of these values for your field, and around that you do your theory. But by this gauge fixing, you have actually explicitly broken the gauge symmetry. There is a way of doing that in a gauge covariant way, which is more complicated. I don't think it's what usually one learns. But so everything is saved, because it is true that you can have a gauge invariant mechanism to produce these masses, but that does not require that the average of your field is different from zero. So here we are proving that the average of our field in a gauge theory must be zero. So what is now the situation is that you could say, okay, so now we have some theory where there is no local order parameter. Well, but that is still, maybe it just corresponds to some other theory in the paramagnetic phase, and that's it. So there are no two phases. Also, the Ising model at high temperature has magnetization that is zero. But in the Ising model, because of the symmetry breaking, you have two phases. So we have to prove that there are two phases. And this, what we do tomorrow.